We got a busy night tonight. We got a packed house tonight, too. That's awesome. But sounds like last night was a busy night, too, as well. Am I right? We had not one, not two. Just kidding. There was only two. Gotcha. Oh, my God. I knew you would fall for that. Two engagements last night. So to the future Marings and future Dumfies, congratulations. Congrats. That's awesome. That'll be fun. And I'm glad you got engaged last night because I want to talk about a wedding tonight. So it's the perfect way to open this teaching. And I will give you somewhat of a, I guess it's a warning. First of all, enjoy engagement. It's going to be a blast, but it'll be gone before you know it. So cherish the time you have while it's here. But one of the hardest things about being engaged in marriage was coming up with the guest list, right? Who you're going to invite. There's so many connections. There's so many, like, implications. Man, if I invite this person, then that means I have to invite this other person. Like, my great aunt Gertie, she's awesome, but her kids, they're kind of weird. Like, if I invite her, that means I got to invite her whole family. But I really just want to invite my Aunt Gertrude. I don't want her kids to come. How do I deal with this? And it's kind of, it's a challenge. I'm not going to lie. So consider yourself forewarned. Coming up with a guest list is a challenge. But tonight, we're talking about a wedding. We're talking about many things, but we're going to open with talking about a wedding that Jesus Christ tells us about. And at this wedding, there is no challenge with the guest list because everyone is invited to it. And we're in Matthew 22, and this is the continuation of, as Kyle called it last week, battle Jesus mode. It's the last week of his ministry, and he is in Jerusalem. It's Passover. He's not really holding back who he is. People are calling him Son of David, the Messiah. He's not really keeping things hush-hush about who he is or his job, what he's doing. He goes into the temple and he flips some tables. He gets into these arguments with like the religious elders and elites and the Pharisees at the time. And last week he told a parable to the Pharisees, the religious elite, like the cream of the crop of the nation of Israel, the Jews last week, or the last chapter that Kyle went over last week. And the point of this parable was, the nation Israel was blessed with the promises of God so that you will be a blessing, so that you will go out and bear fruit. But you have not borne any fruit. So now this nation, the kingdom of God, will pass out of your hands into a nation that will be fruitful. And he continues on, in this context, battle Jesus mode with another parable. Jesus spoke to them. So this is, again, the Pharisees, the Jewish leaders. Jesus spoke to them again in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. And he sent out his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast, and they were unwilling to come. Again, he sent out other slaves, saying, tell those who have been invited, behold, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fattened livestock are all butchered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast." But they paid no attention, and they went their way, one to his farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his slaves and mistreated them and killed them. So, I mean, this is pretty brutal. He's telling a parable about this king who has a son. His son is getting married, and he's throwing a wedding feast. So he sends his servants out to invite people and remind them that today is the day of the wedding. Come on out. And it doesn't go that well. In fact, it goes pretty poorly as you can expect. In fact, they rejected the invitation and even killed his slaves. But continuing on, the king was enraged, and he sent armies and destroyed those murderers and set their city on fire. Then he said to his slaves, "The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Go therefore to the main highways, and as many as you find there, invite to the wedding feast." Those slaves went out into the streets and gathered together all they found, both evil and good. And the wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. So this is a parable. This is a story. It's an illustration. Jesus is trying to convey a truth, a reality through this parable. So it's somewhat easy in many respects to see what he's talking about or what these people or things or events in the story represent, right? The king representing God, the son who's getting married representing Jesus. And then you have this initial round of invitees where they reject the invitation and even kill the slaves. This is the nation Israel. Again, over the throughout the course of history, God has entrusted his promises to nation Israel, and throughout history, he has murdered his prophets, and they have rejected the invitation to be God's chosen people, to be fruitful. So he sends out the second round of invitations to the end of the road, and that's to the Gentiles. That's to us. That's non-Israelites. And contextually speaking, or historically speaking, the way that these types of events would have happened, it wasn't like the servants went out that day and were like, hey, I know you're really busy right now, but you have to come to this wedding right now. There would have been a save the date, right? We still do that. You send an invitation out months in advance. Hey, there's going to be a wedding this specific day in the future. Save the date. It's coming up. So when they go out that day, it's really just a reminder. Today's the day of the wedding. Are you coming? And then they go out a second. They ignore it. Then they go out a second time. The dinner's ready, man. You got to see the spread that the king has lined up. You have not feasted like this ever. I guarantee you, you're not going to want to miss this. But it says they thought lightly of it. In other words, what they were currently occupied with was more important to them than this wedding invitation. It says one had a business, they were busy doing other things. There's a cross-reference passage in Luke 14. I love this one. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first one said to him, I bought a piece of land and I gotta go look at it. Another said, I bought 5 yoke of oxen and I need to try them out. And another one said, I'm married and for that reason I cannot come. But I had a coach in high school. He used to say all the time, whenever we would complain or talk about something being too hard, he would say, excuses are like buttholes. Everyone has them, and they all stink. And that's what's going on here. They all have these terrible excuses. I just bought a field. I got to go look at my field. Like, you know, what happens if I don't go see my field tonight, but I wake up tomorrow and it's not there anymore? What if it just moves? Or what if it's like completely different? I'm sorry, I have to go check my field out tonight. Dude, I'm sorry, that sounds enticing, but I just brought these oxen back from the dealership. I got to try them out. I got to make sure the alignment's okay. It's like, dude, if you are that worried about your ox that they're not going to be the same tomorrow, then you just bought a bad batch of oxen and you have bigger fish to fry. Just come to the party. Come to the wedding. And the marriage thing, like, don't worry, you who just got engaged, you're still going to do things after you got married. This isn't the end of having fun. That in itself, that's a silly excuse. If I went up to Adi, my wife, and I said, hey, the king is throwing the biggest party you've ever seen. You game? Of course. Let's go together. Like, that sounds like an awesome date night. Who would not want to go to the king's son's wedding together? But here they all had these preoccupations. Is it wrong, though, to have these things? Maybe you're kind of squirming in your seat tonight. You just bought a couple of ox and you're worried, did I do the wrong thing? Should I not have purchased this ox? And that's not the problem. Don't worry, getting married is not the problem. The problem that is being addressed here, the issue, is that these things are taking priority over the wedding invitation. These things take precedent. These preoccupations, I am elevating them. They require my immediate attention, so I'm going to reject your invitation. And the king here, you read this and maybe you think he's harsh, but he is patient. He sent out the invitation months in advance. He sends his servants out twice. He pleads with these people, you don't want to miss this. And to be invited to the king's wedding, that has to be such a high honor. Yet, they are the ones who escalated it. They're the ones who responded violently by killing his servants. And then the king, at that point, that's when he responds. And Jesus Christ, you know, telling this to the Pharisees, he is warning them that there is a day of judgment coming for you. If you continue to reject my invitation, if you continue to treat my people like this, judgment is coming. But anyway, so the rejection is invited, and it says, you know, go out to the end of the road. And the Greek here is to the parting of the highways. So there's the main street that goes through town, and then it splinters off after that. I want you to go to where the road splinters. Find anyone you can, both good and bad. I want the goodies and I want the baddies. Invite everybody to this wedding. And I read this and I'm excited about this because I'm from the sticks of Pennsylvania. I am like well past where the road parts. And the invitation made its way out to me. The invitation is making its way out to everybody. And this had to frustrate the Pharisees, because they're the religious elite. These guys are perfect. They follow the law. They tithe just even the micro measurements of their herbs. No one is cleaner and better than the Pharisees. Yet here the wedding invitation is sent out to the boonies, to the bad people. These are the people that I want in my wedding. And here tonight, Jesus Christ is extending the invitation to every single person to come to his wedding feast. If you've been checking out any of these Bible studies, whether it be here at CT or you've been going to a home church or you're just trying to learn about Jesus, he is inviting you to his wedding feast. And he is patient. He is patient with us. He is pursuing us. Yet, we still need to respond. I love how Paul puts it, 2 Corinthians 6. At the acceptable time, this is God speaking, at the acceptable time I listened to you, and on the day of salvation I helped you. Behold, now is the acceptable time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. This, today, is the day to respond. God is pursuing you here tonight. That's why you're here. I know you're here because there's an awesome party afterwards. But you know what? God is still pursuing you. The question in the context of this parable, is there something else that's taking priority? Is there something else that's preoccupying us? If that's the case, then ultimately what we're saying is no. We are taking this invitation lightly. Now, it's easy, and I've heard this a lot. I've even thought it myself before I came to know the Lord, that I'll put this off till later. I'll check out who Jesus Christ is later. I'll check out religion, Christianity, church. I'll check these things off later, right? Right now I'm busy. Maybe I'm in school. I'm trying to get my work situation figured out. I just had a kid. Something happened, right? I'm busy at this moment. I'll do this later. Yet, we don't know what the future holds. And the bottom line is, Jesus Christ is pursuing you right now. He wants to work through your problems. He wants to work through your questions. He wants to know you. He is here, and he is patient with you tonight. And if we are continually preoccupied with Jesus Christ, then it reaches the point where he understands that we have other things, that we have other priorities that are getting in the way between us and the invitation to know him. But going back to this parable with the wedding, there's also the question of what do you wear at a wedding? But when the king came in to look over the dinner guests, he saw a man there who was not dressed in wedding clothes. And he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes?" And the man was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen." And really, verse 14, that's the summary of the whole parable, right? The invitation has gone out to everybody, yet few respond. But here we have this seemingly pretty dramatic escalation of events. The king comes out and he checks out his packed wedding hall, and he spots the one guy who we know who it is in his tuxedo t-shirt. And he gets tossed out. Now, to those who just got engaged, I would advise you, if there is a strict dress code, please put that on the invitation. But like, what exactly is happening here? This seems like just a dramatic, again, like this crazy escalation of events. This guy is bound and thrown out of the wedding because he is not wearing the right clothes. That doesn't really make sense. Now, actually, a couple years ago in seminary, I wrote a paper on the theme of clothes, which, I trust me, is a lot more interesting than you think. And what I had to do with this paper is track clothing and garments throughout the Bible, right? How does this theme progress throughout the Bible from Genesis to Revelation? How does it progress through history? And clothes and garments are mentioned and used in the Bible as a symbol of God's righteousness, being clothed in his righteousness. But here's the thing. Who clothes us with God's righteousness? Do we do it ourselves, or does he do it? He clothes us with righteousness. And at feasts like this, again, consider this the second round of invites. I want you to go out to the boonies, find the bad people, and bring them here. Do they have wedding garments hanging in their closet ready to go? Of course not. But frequently, kings and people of high stature who are throwing these weddings would provide the necessary wedding garments. And you see this surprise when he goes out and he sees someone not wearing the right clothes. And it's surprising because I've been handing out these garments, yet here you are not wearing them. That doesn't make sense. How did you get in? There's an illustration of this in Zechariah 3. I love this passage. In the context of this passage, Zechariah is a prophet, and he's talking here about the high priest Joshua. This is after the nation Israel came back in the Old Testament from being exiled. And Zechariah has a vision. He has a vision of the high priest Joshua. And this is his vision. Now, Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and standing before the angel. The angel spoke and said to those who were standing before him, saying, "Remove the filthy garments from him." Again, he said to him, "See, I have taken away your iniquity, your sin, your filth. I have taken this away from you, and I will clothe you with festal robes." Then I said, "Let him put on a clean turban on his head." So they put on a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments while the angel of the Lord was standing by. Look at this just intimate exchange that we see here in this vision between the high priest Joshua and the angels and the Lord, where he takes these filthy garments off of him and he clothes him with these beautiful festal garments, the clothes of righteousness. God wants to drape all of us in his righteousness. Yet in the story, you can reject it. You can try to come to God in your own terms. You can try to come to God dressed in your own righteousness. And that's what the Pharisees were trying to do. They thought they could approach God because they were good people. They held the law. They tithed. They kept all the rules. They jumped through all the hoops. These were the right people. They thought, "I don't have to wear your clothes, your garments, God. I'm going to come to you as I am." Yet if we try to approach God without the garbs of his righteousness, he will throw us out. And this flies in the face of the belief in culture today that you can come to God however you want, that all religions lead you to the same heaven. All beliefs get you to the same spot. Religion is what you want it to be. Christianity is what you want it to be. Even today, people are distorting what Christianity is. I can come to God on my own terms. Whatever works for you works for you. Whatever works for me works for me. But that's not what the Bible says. 1 Timothy 2, "For there is one God, and there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all." This is the only way. The only way we can get into heaven is by being clothed in the righteousness of God, and he provides that righteousness. He offers to clothe you. All you have to do is respond. And remember, today is the day of salvation. Today is the day to respond. And please don't misinterpret this parable or misinterpret any of these verses, this passage in Zechariah, this doesn't mean that you have to clean yourself up. This doesn't mean that you have to find the right clothes, put them on, and then come to God. God is offering to clothe you himself. Jesus Christ says, come to me, anyone who is dirty, anyone who is weary, anyone who is anxious, broken, fearful, mistreated, forgotten, cast aside. Come to me, and I will clothe you. That's what he's offering. This is the intimate exchange that he is offering. He will take your garments of filth, the sin from your life, and clothe you in righteousness. And that's what this parable is all about. And obviously, the Pharisees, who this parable is directed to, would have been offended. They just got put on blast multiple times through these parables with Jesus. So they decide to retaliate. Then the Pharisees went and plotted together how they might trap him and what he said, how they might trap Jesus. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. These would have been people who were politically aligned with Herod, saying, "Teacher, we know," and if anyone wants to say this to me after the teaching, feel free, "we know that you are truthful and that you teach the way of God of truth." I'm just kidding. Please don't tell me this. "We know this, Lord. We know that you defer to no one. We know that you are not partial. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not?" So they approach Jesus, they lay it on thick, they really butter him up, and then they ask him, "Should we pay taxes?" You couldn't think of anything better to ask at this point in time. Should we pay taxes? But actually, it is a pretty challenging question. The political and the religious climate at this time would have been ridiculously tense. This is the thick of Roman oppression. This is in Jerusalem around Passover. This place is flooded with Jewish people coming to practice or to worship at Passover. And again, remember, this is the thick of Roman oppression. So they come to him, and people want a revolution. The Jewish people want a revolution. Let us overthrow this Roman government. And this is, if you've seen The Chosen, like the how wild it is that Jesus picked a zealot and a tax collector, two people on opposite ends of the spectrum. But anyway, incredible tension at this point in time. And they come up to Jesus, and they ask, "Are you supporting this oppression? Are you supporting Roman oppression? I mean, aren't you the king of the Jews? Shouldn't you be on our side with this?" And what's he going to do? Say, "Don't pay taxes?" I guarantee you there's some Roman officials listening to this conversation. What do you think happens to Jesus at that point in time? He says, "Yeah, actually, screw the Romans. Don't pay taxes." And then, you know, flips them off. He's screwed. But this is his response. He perceived their malice. "Why are you testing me, you hypocrites? You think I am that dumb? Give me a coin. Give me a coin that you use to pay taxes." And they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is on this coin? And they said, "Him, Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Well, render to Caesar the thing that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And hearing this, they were amazed. I love this. Even the Pharisees, who tried to trump him, they were amazed and they left. There's nothing that they can do. And Christ's response here is absolutely brilliant, because he's saying the realms that we are operating in and talking about are completely different. You're talking about this temporary life here on earth. So yeah, give these coins to Caesar, because I want something more than that. I want something more significant than that. And remember, you know, he says, in other words, what he's saying with the coin is, this coin is made in the image of who? Caesar. You are made in the image of who? God. That's what I want. I don't want your change, your coins. I want you. You bear the image of God, so render to God the things that are God's. And this is what he wants from us. Keep this in mind when you're considering this invitation, is he wants you. Religion gets caught up in the rules, the politics, the hair splitting, the debates. Jesus Christ wants to know you. And as believers, this is how we continue to relate with Jesus Christ. Romans 12:1, present your bodies as a holy sacrifice. This is what it looks like to interact, to relate with the Lord, is to render your body to him. Jesus doesn't want the religious way of relating with us. He wants us. He doesn't want us to show up and leave, check the boxes, and go home. He wants a relationship. He is pursuing us. So here the Pharisees strike out, and that means it's the Sadducees' turn. The Sadducees were another group of Jewish believers. They had somewhat different beliefs than the Pharisees. And I'll skim this, but ultimately they have this argument that comes from Moses. And they say, if a man dies having no children, his brother as next of kin shall marry his wife and raise up children for his brother. And this is a law that took place in the Old Testament. This is the levirate marriage. If you were a woman and you got married and you didn't have any sons and your husband died, you as a widow had no one to take care of you. You are living in harsh times in a harsh area, harsh climate. How are you going to provide for yourself? So the law provided by God as a provision was your husband's brother will marry you. He will provide for you. So this law is looking out for widows. And again, that just kind of shows the character of God. But anyway, they come to Jesus with this question. Say this lady marries this guy and he dies. But he's got a big family. He's got a lot of brothers. And they all marry him. And something fishy is going on because each and every one of them die. Who gets to marry? Who is married in the afterlife? So that's their argument. Again, this is absurd. And first of all, this is an insult. They're not trying to have a theological discussion. It says that they don't even believe in the resurrection. Yet their question is, if this woman marries seven guys in the resurrection, who is she married to? They don't even believe in the resurrection. This is like someone coming, you know, if you're a Christian, someone comes up to you and they don't believe in heaven. And they're like, oh, so you're going to heaven when you die? What kind of wings are you going to get? Boneless wings. But it's not an argument, right? They don't, it's not like, hey, I'm actually theologically curious as to the answer of this question. It's an insult. They are insulting Christ here. But he still responds, you are mistaken because you don't understand Scripture and you don't understand the power of God. For in the resurrection, there will be neither marriage nor anyone given in marriage, but we are like angels in heaven. But regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what is spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the living, of the dead, but of the living. Let me repeat that because I messed it up. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And again, when the crowds heard this, they were astonished. They were amazed. So it's fascinating because they don't want to actually know this. They're not trying to understand, yet he still answers their question. And he corrects them. He provides guidance. And he quotes here from Exodus 3:6, where it says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Here's the kind of quirk about him quoting this. And it says that I am the God of the living. When Exodus 3:6 was written, Abe, Isaac, and Jacob were dead like a really long time ago. Yet he says that I am the God of the living. If Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were dead and there was no resurrection, why didn't he say that he is the God of the dead? Yet he says, he makes a specific point here, that he is the God of the living. He is the God of the living. These three dudes were dead. The implication here is that they must be alive in the resurrection somewhere. They are existing somewhere right now. Does that make sense? Are you tracking? And there's some application here for us too, and this is why I am so impressed with our fellowship here, because we do prioritize the studying of the word. That's why we have classes. This is why we have discipleship, because the application, and what he's telling him is, have you not read this? And he's diving in deep to this passage. He's interpreting this for them. Do you see the implications of this passage? But anyway, the Sadducees, they strike out. So 0-2, it's the Pharisees' turn again. But when the Pharisees heard that Jesus silenced the Sadducees, they gathered themselves together. And one of them, who was a lawyer, asked Jesus a question, testing him. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And first of all, if you were to actually, you know, sit down and read this whole passage back to back, you would get kind of this barraging effect with Christ. The Pharisees send their disciples and the Herodians go up to Jesus and they ask a question. And he stumps them. They're on their way back and then the Sadducees come up and they ask them questions. Then the Pharisees find out that the Sadducees sailed and they're excited because they get another shot. So this time they send in a lawyer. You get this sense that these people, there is this tension and they are trying to silence Jesus Christ. They're trying to embarrass him. They're trying to test him, right? They're trying to take Jesus Christ down, yet they are continually failing. And there's also kind of like this sense of competition too, right? The Pharisees heard that the Sadducees failed. All right, it's our turn again. But this time, we're going to send in the big guns. So they send a lawyer, literally, it would translate a man of the law. It's possible it would have been a scribe. Either way, this was someone who knew the law. And he tests them. What is the most important law? And again, it might seem like a simple question, but it has potent implications. At Passover, in front of a bunch of Jews, what is Jesus? There's no way that he's going to throw the whole law out, right? Or if he, maybe he will actually take the bait and answer this question, but then he's elevating the priority of one law, but we have hundreds of laws. Is he saying those other laws are less important? Because they would have viewed every law as equally important. So is Jesus Christ really just going to select one? The point is, they're trying to trap him. They're testing him. But he answers. And he said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. And he quotes two Old Testament passages. And one, every single one of them would have known it. It's the Shema from Deuteronomy 6. Love your God with your whole heart, soul, and mind. So he quotes a passage that, first of all, they would have all known. Would have been the most famous passage. They all had it memorized. They would have had it written down. It would have been everywhere that they looked. This was their passage, the Shema, Deuteronomy 6. So he quotes to them a passage that they know, and he quotes these people who are trying to live the highest, the law to the fullest, and he says, are you loving God as much as you can? Do you love him with your whole heart, soul, and mind? That's impossible. And also, Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. And he's doing a tremendous thing here. He is joining the vertical love for God with the horizontal love for your neighbors, for those around you. I want you to love other people. I want you to love God. And there, the Pharisees are so caught up, and religion, period, is so caught up in hair splitting and these debates and these issues, these debacles, that they miss the point. What does God care about? He cares about love. And this strikes me because the people who say the God of the Old Testament is different than the God of the New Testament, because the God of the Old Testament was mean. Jesus Christ says the entire Old Testament is summed up in this idea, love. And when Jesus Christ talks about love, it's not, you know, mushy-gushy good feelings. He says in John 15:12, I want you to love one another as I have loved you. Love is a sacrifice. That's my priority. That should be your priority. Is love. And again, religion loses sight of love. Religion gets caught in performance. And as a believer, as a Christian, this should be what guides our life, our interactions with one another, is love. I find myself all too often in preparing for discipleship or cell group or any meeting, thinking about the people around me in a way where I am focusing on maybe where they've messed up, or sins or issues, areas that need correction. And I'm not saying that there isn't a time for correction, but what I am not prioritizing and what Jesus Christ is calling on us here is, what am I doing today that is loving them? when we walked through these doors this morning, were we thinking, how am I loving somebody today? How am I loving somebody at this meeting today? When you come home after work, when I come home after work and I'm tired, am I thinking, how can I love my wife? How can I love my kids? This is what the Lord is calling on us, to love one another. How many of you have seen Jesus Revolution? It's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, go see it. Tremendous movie. But one of my favorite scenes was when Greg Laurie gets baptized. You know what I'm talking about? And if you haven't seen the movie, it follows this young man at the time, Greg Laurie, in the middle of the Jesus Revolution amongst the hippies in California. And Greg Laurie isn't a believer, but one of the primary guys who's reaching out to and evangelizing and witnessing to and relating with him is this guy, Lonnie Frisbee. Coolest name ever, Lonnie Frisbee. And Greg Laurie is debating, and he's working through these issues and these challenges. And then one day, there's this big baptism event at Pirate's Cove out in the beach off California. And Greg Laurie's there, and he decides, you know what, I'm doing it. And what's his name? Lonnie Frisbee is out in the ocean baptizing people, and Greg Laurie goes up to him, and he prays with Lonnie Frisbee to get saved, and then Lonnie Frisbee baptizes him. It's a beautiful scene. But what punched me in the gut was when, as Greg Laurie is approaching, Lonnie Frisbee says, I have been praying for this moment since the first time I met you. And like, when I meet people, especially when I meet non-Christians, I'm typically thinking about like barriers. You know, why is this person the least possible candidate to know the Lord? What are their issues in their life? What are things that are going to get in the way? I don't view them in a sense of like I'm being considerate of what they're going through, but I'm viewing them as like, man, this is going to be impossible. This is hard. That's the religious way to view it. How is this guy performing? What is he like? Where is he failing? But here in this movie and in this passage, it's, dude, I love you. I'm going to pray for you. I pray that someday you will come to know the Lord and that you will get baptized. That is the ethic of love that Jesus Christ is calling on us here to pursue. So they tried the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians. They tried politics. They tried religion. They tried the law. And Jesus Christ stumped all of them. But now it's his turn to ask a question. Now, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. What do you think about the Christ, the Messiah? Whose son is he? They said to him, the son of David. He said to them, then how does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies beneath your feet? If David calls him Lord, how is he his son? And this is a quote from Psalm 110. And then this is where the chapter ends. I love it. No one was able to answer him a word, nor did anyone dare from that day on to ask him another question. They learned their lesson. But he asks them this question. Who is the Messiah? Who is the Christ? And his goal with this question is to get them to recognize the reality of who they are talking to. And they answer, they respond, the Christ, as is identified in the Old Testament, is the son of David. This is what people yelled at the triumphal entry a couple weeks ago when Jesus came in. They were calling on the son of David. But Jesus says, okay, so you think the Messiah is the human son of David, is a human being. Let's push that a little bit. In Psalm 110, David calls the son of David Lord. I have two sons. I've called them a lot of things. I have never called them Lord. They might want me to call them that, but I do not call them that. But he's pushing their interpretation, their understanding. You say that the son of David is man, but David himself called the son of David Lord. You say that I am son of David, yet David views him as God. Do you realize that you are talking to God right now? And this is what he's trying to do. He's trying to help them make this connection. And this might get lost on us a little bit, and I apologize if it does, but the function of this is for the Pharisees to understand that they are talking with God. And that is their problem. Their problem isn't with marriage. Their problem isn't with taxes. Their problem isn't with the law. Their problem is they don't know who God is. They don't have a relationship with God. And again, if you're here tonight and you're investigating, maybe you've been investigating for a while, I know how easy it is to get caught up in the hypotheticals and the arguments and the what ifs, or, you know, how does this make sense, the problems. And Jesus does have answers to those. You know, these three sets of people came up to Christ multiple times, all trying to trap him with these questions. And he saw every single one of them as a trap. He did not need to answer the questions, yet he chose to. I know you have questions. He will answer those questions. He wants to answer those questions. He may not answer them right now, but he is asking you a question. Who do you say Jesus Christ is? Who is Jesus Christ to you? And there's this contrast that is built throughout this whole chapter. You have the religious, the rules, the hair splitting, their performance, this anxiety, right? You sense this kind of anxiety within the Pharisees and the Sadducees, like, how are we going to stop this guy? That's what religion looks like. It's just this anxiety, this performance. How am I going to make this work? And Jesus is saying, I am the God of a living and breathing church. I am not the God of a dead institution. I don't want your rules. I don't want your performance. I want your heart. I want to know you. I want to fill up my banquet hall. Will you respond to this invitation? And if you're here and you don't know Jesus Christ, please walk away tonight knowing that he is extending this invitation to you. He'll answer your questions. You don't have to come to him perfect. You don't have to clean yourself up. He will clothe you in robes of righteousness. He just wants to know you. And the Bible tells us of an actual wedding that happens between Christ and his bride, the church, us, in the end. Revelation 19. Let us rejoice and be glad and give glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean. For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words. There will be a wedding feast someday, the wedding feast of Jesus Christ. And he has invited you. He has invited all of us. You don't have to come prepared. You don't have to come wearing the right clothes. Jesus Christ will clothe you. You don't have to do anything for it. And it's significant that he invites us to a wedding. It's not a funeral, and it's not a draft summons, right? You have to come to this. He invites you to a wedding. You got all of you who are engaged, you're going to have a blast at your wedding. It is such a tremendous time. Weddings are so amazing. They're so fun. And Jesus Christ is inviting us to the greatest wedding that will ever take place. He just wants to know you. And he wants you to know him. Will you respond to him tonight? This idea, you know, that maybe I need more time or I'm busy right now. I promise you, and this is my experience, I guarantee you, you talk to many people who are older than me, they will verify this. You will never get less busy. You will never be less preoccupied than you get right now. As you get older, more and more things are fighting for your preoccupation, for your attention, fighting for your allegiance. But you know what? Your field, it's going to be there tomorrow. Your oxen will be there tomorrow. Your job, whatever you're preoccupied with, will be there tomorrow. So why not respond tonight? So I'm going to go ahead and pray. And if you want to pray to receive the Lord, I'll address that here too. But anyway, Lord, we need you. We know we need you. We're broken people. Broken people can't fix broken people. We can't save ourselves. We can't fix ourselves. We can't clothe ourselves in righteousness, but you have done all of that for us, Lord. You offer to clothe us. You offer to redeem us. And you paid such a high price to do that, Lord. You sent your son to die on the cross to redeem us, to make that available, to clothe us in righteousness. The death that we deserve, he paid for us in our stead so that we can dine with you at the wedding feast, so that we can dine with you for eternity. Just thank you so much, Lord, for making that happen. Thank you for pursuing us. Thank you for that invitation. And if you're here tonight and you want to respond to the Lord's invitation, you can do that tonight. You can do that in the privacy of your own heart. Just have to pray like this. I ask you, Lord, to save me. Lord, I want your death on the cross to pay for my sins. Lord, I want to know you, and I want to die with you, or dine with you in eternity. Lord, please come into my life here tonight. And if you did that, praise God. I can't wait to dine with you in eternity at the wedding feast. But that's all I had for tonight. We do still have a party here tonight. But if we have any questions or comments, feel free to come up to the mic. We also got the bags going around. Again, you know, if you're a guest, we don't expect you to drop anything in the bag unless it's a prayer card. If you do have a prayer card, you can drop that in there as well. But thanks everybody for coming out. But yeah, any questions or thoughts? Carrie?
That was phenomenal teaching, Ian. Thank you so much. So I was, you know, the passage and a lot of through Jesus's ministry, you know, you learn a lot about the Pharisees, and I guess I've been kind of naive, but I didn't realize the churches are still rampant with Pharisees. I was talking to a woman this morning who her son has a disability, and she was looking for a fellowship, looking for a church. She got rejected by two churches because they couldn't accommodate her son.
Wow.
And then she went to another one that she thought was pretty, you know, she's enjoyed the teaching, enjoyed the people. And afterwards, they had a meet the pastor type thing. And apparently, you know, she advertised on her with a bumper sticker on her car which way she voted. And she was asking about membership. And he said to her, the first thing you need to do is repent of who you voted for.
Jeez.
And these are in our area. And I was like, oh my God. It was heartbreaking. Yeah. Just this one woman's story. So, yeah, great teaching.
It is so easy for us to think we're not the Pharisees, right? That we don't focus on performance or we don't get caught up in the details. But, I mean, we're called to love. That's our priority, is to love. Thanks for sharing that. What's up, John?
Hey. It's really good stuff. I really resonate with that wrong clothing, being in the wrong dirty clothes and all that. In my mind, and this is actually something that Tournier was really like passionate about too. It's how we mask ourselves and how we're taught to like hide who we really are because people won't like that, so we got to pretend to be somebody else.
Yeah.
And we've lived this lie and we believe this lie throughout our entire life. That if people saw who we truly were, then they wouldn't want us.
Yeah.
And so that lie gets connected to God. Mm-hmm. And there's that fear of like, if God sees me for who I really am, he won't want me. He'll reject me.
Yeah.
And that's the most ironic thing, because God's the only one who can truly see through our masks, our filthy clothes, to see the valuable thing that he blessed us with, or just how he created us. And that's a very hard step to believe, but it's true, because he's the one who created you before you even had a chance to put on a mask. but also it's both ways. God's not going to put on a mask for you.
Yeah.
He's not going to pretend to be somebody else. He's not going to pretend to be some other entity. He is who he is. And he wants a relationship with you as you are with him who he is. And so I love that idea or the concept of the clothing. Because you want to hide and you're like, if you just keep me like, I'm just going to keep, you know, clothing myself and hiding myself. And it's like, stop it. Just be intimate with him.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And that's why I love that Zechariah passage, because it just exudes like intimacy with the Lord. And yeah, he wants drop the facade. He knows who you are. He made you. He knit you together in your mother's womb. He knows every detail about you. So why not relate to him on that? Thanks, John.
Good evening.
Carlo? Good evening. How are you doing?
Hey, I got an online question for you. Then I got a personal example after that.
Okay.
Online question: in heaven, will there be a literal wedding, or is this kind of, like a metaphor? Mm. If literal, who's at the altar?
That's a interesting question. So let me go back to that Revelation passage. Revelation is steeped in a lot of prophecy and symbology and things like that. But what's fascinating about this is the way the passage ends. These are the true words of God. So it's, and he says, write these things. These are the true words of God. So he's really calling his attention to the legitimacy of this. And I don't want us to get caught up in the details of, you know, what are there going to be enough seats? Like, that's going to be a really big table. Like, what's the food going to be? Do I announce my allergy ahead of time? Because the point is that we are invited and he wants us to respond. So getting caught up in the details, I think, partially misses the point. But I also know that the Lord wants to relate with us in this intimate way at a wedding. But I mean, I would encourage whoever sent that in to check out some of these passages in Revelation 19. I think there's some in 7 as well, to see what it says about it, and to maybe dig in a little bit as to, you know, why they have that question. But I don't know if that makes sense. But
thank you.
Yeah.
My personal application, or maybe add on to what you were saying. One thing I want to note: pretty cool promotion you said at Jesus Revolution, because he's coming April 8th here. So that is, I mean, if that doesn't sway anyone coming April 8th, I don't know what else could. But the whole, besides that, Jesus, still on Jesus Revolution, though. The verse there where you shared about where the Lord responded,
love God.
Yeah, love God with all your heart, your mind.
And love your neighbors, yourself.
I think that was portrayed very good in the movie, because we saw what rejection looked like. Where the church, Calvary Chapel, was, they didn't like the hippies.
Yeah.
They're dirtying up the carpet. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was
And one of the most beautiful scenes in that movie, man. It, like, got teared up because Pastor Chuck was there washing those hippies' feet and showing them love.
Yep.
And that was the biggest part of the whole Jesus movement, was hippies were finally seeing truth through the Christians.
Isn't
stop
that
rejection.
Worth celebrating?
Yeah, and love in there. So I don't know. That was really cool. I think that's one of the points that Jesus was trying to make, and it makes so much sense because we've seen it in our lifetime, how powerful it is to love someone as yourself, love your neighbor as yourself. It's just so beautiful. So,
and I love the scene when the guy, everyone gets up and leaves, but the one guy changes sides.
Yeah, yeah.
That was awesome too. But yeah, just what a beautiful picture. And what I have been thinking, and you know, in alignment with this passage too, if we as a fellowship are going to prioritize love, who are the hippies around us that are dirty and hard to love? And how do we love them? Who are the hippies for us right now, for Freedom Fellowships, or for us, for your cell group? And how can we take this commandment to love my neighbor as myself seriously and love them? What does it look like to love them, to pursue them? Not play the religion game of you're too dirty, or you're not like me, or you're different, or you're never going to understand this. But regardless of those differences, I love you, and I can't wait for you to know the Lord someday.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Carlo. Hey, Jeremiah.
Actually, your comment was almost exactly, I just had an example almost of something exactly like that. But I was thinking too, on the coming up behind Carlo's comment, that it's really funny how, and this is sort of even related to John Hakes, what he was talking about, how everyone knows what rejection feels like.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny how we really don't know what acceptance feels like. And that the Lord is really the only one who will actually accept you. But my comment, we had this guy at my workplace, extremely awkward dude. Nobody likes him. He is very socially awkward to an obnoxious, like there's some people where you're socially awkward and you're like, oh, they're
it's charming.
Cute. It's, well, they're, what are the, like, there's a adorkable, I think is like the word visual. And you're like, that's stupid. But he's not adorkable. He's just an obnoxious idiot. And but as a Christian, you start feeling convicted. Like, I shouldn't think that about this dude. That's, you know, why is he like this? And we were coming up, like, even in the management team of which I'm part, you know, this dude, his name is David. Poor David. Well, he's got like some kind of nominal mental health things. And he's just, you know, let's put him over in the corner where he kind of give him a coloring book and crayons and just hopefully he doesn't like ruin anything. And it dawned on me one day, and I think I'd been reading the parable that we read tonight from another gospel, I think it was. I can't remember.
Luke.
Yeah, from Luke. And it dawned on me, and I was like, man, why do I keep forgetting this? That, and it's told a little differently in that parable, where the king sends out his servants and he tells them to go collect people from like under the hedge, under the bushes. Yeah. And it dawned on me that, first of all, I'm one of the people from under the bush. But like, namely, like now I kind of think of myself as sitting at the table. So I'm inclined to a superiority view of myself. And then there's these people like David, this dude at my work, who I would highly doubt he has a relationship with the Lord. I'm like, okay, he's still under the hedge. And so one day my boss, who is also a Christian, everybody on the management team is a Christian, just kind of by not design, we just are. But my boss was, it was frustration. Like, David, oh, this guy. And I said, John, I had a realization about him yesterday. He's under the hedge. We have to figure out a way to draw him out of it, out from under the hedge. Second, I don't think he has any friends. That's why he's so kooky. And because that happens when you don't have relationships, you become kooky.
Yeah.
And just on the, to follow your comment up that you had just said about who is the Lord leading you to? Who are the hippies, so to speak? They are going to be people who no one else will befriend.
Yeah.
And when you realize that, you're like, oh, God gave me power for a reason. It's not to go be friends with celebrities. It's to be friends with kooks and people who need that's it's funny to say, but I have never met anyone who needed Jesus more than kooky people. And relationally kooky people are very easy to come by, and they're extremely easy to ignore. All you have to do is look under the relational hedges of life and you will find them. Pick up a rock. They're like a nest of salamanders. So I just thought that what you said was really good tonight.
Thanks for sharing that. I'll be praying for that guy. It's cool. Hey, Angie.
There you go. Yeah. Is that going to work? Okay. So sounds like everybody's thinking along the same lines here, like this idea of being clothed in God's righteousness and not having to be cleaned up before we come to him. And I just wanted to share an experience I had this morning that I think is just such a good illustration of this. I don't know, is Connie Schuf's here? No, I don't know. Connie Schuf and I went out with Rahab this morning to part of their prison ministry to a halfway house to do a Bible study. And one of the women there gave the most beautiful testimony.
Wow.
She was talking about her life before she came to Christ. And it was all the bad things you can imagine. I mean, there's somebody dressed in dirty rags. It was her.
Yeah.
And then she said, the Lord rescued me when I was arrested. So here is this point in her life where she gets busted.
Yeah.
She is arrested. And that's where she identifies. The Lord rescued her.
Wow.
And she was so full of thanksgiving and praise for being rescued out of that life, and not, I mean, and she was not cleaned up when she when she was rescued. She was not. She was at a low point. Anyway, I just thought that was such a beautiful illustration.
That is
of
awesome.
This.
Wow.
And it's been with me all day.
Yeah.
Just her words. The Lord rescued me when I was arrested. So
she was not wearing the right clothes then. That's for sure. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's beautiful. Cool. Well, thanks for coming out. What time's the party start? Right now, I'd imagine. Wow, the communal Ansel. Jeez.